This is the CC Radio Podcast.
Welcome along, countdowners, to this bonus episode of the show. I am here and Wayne...
Bitch, please.
...is not, because he had better things to be doing. Now, we'll talk about why he's not here in just a few moments, but it is a pleasure to have you along to the show where we count down movies from, you know, order of awesomeness from worst to best. In this case, just from best to awesome, so you don't have to make those tough decisions. And today, I have with me a first-time guest of the show, but a long-time listener and supporter of the show, Julio from the Contrarians Podcast. Julio, welcome to the countdown.
Hello. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to not only be talking to you, but to see you with this whole invention of Werby or Whereby, whatever you pronounce it. So that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. It's the wonder of quarantine that suddenly we're available. So many of us are just available anytime, all the time. And like I told you, right, when we were planning this, I was like, I'm eager to see new faces whenever possible. I've been quarantined. So yeah. So nice to see somebody that's not my wife or my cats.
And it's nice to see you too. And for you to join us today in this first of a series of shows, which I need to explain a little bit about. So this is the beginnings of my top 100 films of all time. And so how this worked out was I'd said to Wayne, we should end the show, when you eventually do, with our favorite 10 films of all time. In fact, the last two episodes will be our versions of the 10 best films of all time and then our 10 favorite films of all time. So differentiating between the two. Wayne said, yeah, that sounds okay. I guess I can do 10. I said, well, what if we did our top 100? And he said, fuck no, I'm not doing that. In fact, I think he said,
this is the dumbest shit anyone ever said in the history of, and I don't think I'm exaggerating here, time.
And so he steadfastly refused. And so then B-Dizzle from the We Watch the Thing podcast said, well, why don't you just get different podcasters in to count through 10 of their 100 along with you getting down to the top 10. Now, I want to reassure people, this is not 10 weeks away from the end of the show or anything like that. And Julio did ask this question before we started recording. This is just starting the process off. And it could be 5 or 6 years from now, as long as we've gone already before we wrap up the show. Who knows? It could be a year away. We just don't know at this stage. But it's not the beginning of the end, so to speak. It's just a good excuse for a bonus episode and to get a new podcaster on whom I greatly admire. Because your show, Julio, is a hell of a lot of fun. Tell us, our listeners, about it.
Our show, my friend Alex and I, we rage against Rotten Tomatoes machine, as
best line
we like
ever
to say. Yeah. We basically take a movie and look at its score on Rotten Tomatoes. We'll take something that's fresh or rotten and then argue against that rating. So if it's a fresh movie, something like, I don't know, Jaws, we'll argue about it. We'll talk about it as if it was a bad movie. We'll say that it's anti-shark propaganda or whatever. And, If it's a rotten movie, then we'll talk about it as if it was great. If we were doing Paul Blart Mall Cop, then we'll talk about how that's awesome representation of a working class hero or whatever. So it's fun. We mostly do it to have fun, kind of point out the flaws and the way that Rotten Tomatoes is considered some sort of quality marker when it's more of a popularity marker. And then on the second half of the show, we tell you how we really feel, because, you know, we may talk trash about Jaws, but then we can tell you that, no, we actually think it's okay. And same thing, Paul Blart, no, it's not really a good movie. But it's fun to pretend that it is.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Do you reckon there are a bunch of people who start listening to an episode of your show and just go, holy shit, fuck this, and turn it off?
I know. I know that happens.
Because you take it very seriously at the start. It sounds like you're deadly serious about the criticisms that you have or the praise you have for a shit film.
Yeah, we had to change after a while because we realized that too many people were taking us seriously. And they weren't even listening to the second half. Mm-hmm. They would just get angry because we were trashing a popular movie.
The Dark Knight.
And they would just, yes. So we slowly kind of like started making it clear that no, we're 100% joking in the first half. Sometimes that's the thing. The fun thing about the real talk, the second half of the movie, is that sometimes we do agree with what we were saying in Contreras Corner. It's just in Contreras Corner we're being sillier and just more over the top about our opinions, whether they go one way or another. But like, you know, American Hustle is a movie that both Alex and I hate. We think it's terrible. And it's a fresh movie. It's like in the 90s in the tomato meter. So when we did the American Hustle episode, we trashed it in Contrarian's Corner the first half, and then we trashed it again in real talk. It's just that in real talk, we were a lot more serious about it. But yeah, it's I tell everybody, it's fun. It's mostly the main reason behind it is because that it gives me an opportunity to hang out with one of my best friends and just talk about movies.
I hear that.
And then, I mean, yeah, you have that experience, you know, it's you and Wayne, and then it just, that experience kind of grows into this when you become part of this community and discover that everybody else that has similar interests and are doing it the same way or just similar way. So, yeah, we just kind of have fun being controversial in quotation marks because it's really, we're really not that much of a contrarians in real life.
Well, and I think if you haven't checked out the Julio show, do absolutely. It's a lot of fun. And Julio and Alex are very, how do I say, educational, I think. Much more intelligent about their film reviews than Wayne and I are. So take that with you if you're looking for eventually a serious perspective on a film. So anyway, it's great to have you here. How did you find putting this list together? And Julio, you had about 4 days before when we talked and then now to recording to order your 100 favorite films. Was this tough?
Yes, it was crazy because I've been avoiding this, doing something like this. The closest I've gotten is I had a list of my top 25 movies in on Letterboxd.
Yep.
But even then, I narrowed down a lot just by allowing myself only one movie per director. So it was a lot easier. I would just go down my favorite directors and pick my favorite movie out of their filmographies and then organize it. So it was a lot easier to do it that way. This is just, you know, I basically, over the past few days, I had to think of every movie I've seen, and I ended up with a short list of 145 movies. I thought of everything that was great that came to mind right away. And then I looked at all the movies I owned to see if I'd missed anything. And then I looked at all the movies that we've done on the show to see if like that sparked anything. I did not go, if I'd had more time, maybe I would have, I did not go online to look at lists of best 100 movies.
Right, so it's all from the gut, in other words.
Mostly from the gut. And that goes for the arranging as well, because I think you mentioned it, you guys must have talked about it in one of your episodes, probably, where you were telling Wayne, it's easy, you just go one by one, right? You just compare two of them, and then the winner moves up. Or, you know, or the loser moves down and then you go on to the next one. And so that's, I mean, in theory, that's pretty simple. But really, the problem is that it gets really hard when you're comparing movies that are very, very different.
Yeah, agreed. You know,
if it's like a different genre and a different
agreed.
Tone. So the main criteria when I was making the movie, when I was ranking them, was just how it affected me.
There you go.
Not so much the technical aspect, but if I needed some sort of tiebreaker, I would go to the technical aspect. You know, if I think that there's a performance that's weak, or if I think that there's something that they shot weirdly. But the main thing is, okay, when I think of this movie, when I watch this movie, how do I feel inside? Am I just excited about watching a piece of cinema? Does it move me because of nostalgia, or because of what it's saying, or because of what it does for the medium? So that really, that's the top tier, which is not what we're going to be talking about, are those movies.
Well, that's right. It's probably worth emphasizing, you've had the hardest job of all the guests that I will have on eventually. Yours is the hardest job because you had to do all 100 to get to 100 to 91. So
yes.
Hat is off to you, sir, and you did in such a short period of time.
I had to do 145.
You went on the whole way. Okay, 145. My shortlist was about 125 films, and I've had that for a long time. All I had to do was add the last 2 or 3 years worth to it and then start ordering. So my job was easier in that regard.
I was going to ask you how long you'd been working on it.
Oh, I must have been before the podcast even started. I started on my top 100 films list, and now I have, I mean, I'll say settled on it. I'll settle on it for the purposes of this. But who knows? We could watch something over the next 1, 2, 3 years. It forces its way in, which means my 100 would drop off and so on and so forth. But it is what it is. And I'll, if that happens, when I start the next episode, I will say, hey, that film's gone and this one is now in and everything's shuffled down. So, oh, I won't say which one, but something's come in. And when we get there, I will acknowledge it.
Well, that's the other thing that I was telling you just when we were getting ready to record. I wish in a perfect world I would have had time to rewatch not all 145, but at least the ones where I was feeling iffy. There's one in the movies that I have here that we're going to talk about. There's one that I wish I'd had time to rewatch, but at the time, obviously, I didn't know that it was going to land in, you know,
where it was
91 to 100. So I didn't prioritize that. It's rewatching movies that you haven't seen in years. Can change how you feel about them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We just did an episode about Boyhood, which I remember loving when it came out. I was on the camp that was just all about that movie. And a lot of it is very subjective, right? Just what I was talking about. It was a movie that I felt was a great achievement because of the way it was done, because of what it was, the experiment itself, right? And what it was trying to do and all that stuff. So whenever somebody pointed out any of its shortcomings, I was like, yeah, it doesn't matter because the big picture is more important and it's more powerful. And then watching it now, it didn't work for me at all. The gimmick was, I was over it. And all I could think about was just like all the ways in which it was falling short. And
all I could think about is how long it was when I watched it.
Yeah,
well, it's really long.
It's, not to get too much on Boyhood, but that's a movie that really, to me, the older the kid gets, the less interesting it becomes.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not really his fault. It's just that, you know, it has to do with the way they shot it or whatever. You know, it's like his story becomes less interesting. He becomes a typical teenager. There's nothing too interesting to say about him in the last 30 minutes of the movie or so. So that went from a 5-star to a 3-star. And as I was ranking these, I was like, how many of these movies that I consider really good would just not even be included if I rewatch them? So
yeah, I 100% agree with you. And I think there's some on my list here which people will go, what? And again, we'll talk about why, primarily rather than the film itself, because I think in almost all cases, everyone will be familiar with the 10 on my list. Well, one or two might be an exception, but we'll get there.
How crazy would it be if we had a crossover?
Well, I was going to ask you, do you reckon there's any chance, and looking at my 10, and I mean, I don't want to pretend like I know you that well, Julio. I've got a sense of your taste in films. I reckon there's only one possibility of my bottom 10, maybe more than that, but being in the 91 to 100, probably not.
Yeah, that's the thing. From 91 to 100, I can't imagine that we have a crossover. I'm sure that I have at least a couple of movies that are in your top 100.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And
some towards
the
top.
You might as well, but I guess we'll find out.
All right, well, let's find out now. Julio, take us away. Your 100th favorite film of all time, at least according to this moment right now.
According to this moment, this movie, I've seen it more than once. It's been a few years, but I know it pretty well. So I'm confident with knowing that I think it's a great movie. It's from one of my favorite directors, maybe my favorite director. It's Manhattan Murder Mystery from Woody Allen.
Okay, I've never seen it, but all right.
It's a pure comedy. It's not one of his more complex movies. Those are higher up the list. It's basically the movie that made me a Woody Allen fan. It's not the first Woody Allen movie I watched. Mm-hmm. When I was in film school, one of our teachers showed us Husbands and Wives, and I hated it. It's like shaky cam, and it's all interviews, and it's really depressing. And I walked out, and I was like, I don't want anything to do with this filmmaker. And then maybe a year or two later, I saw Manhattan Murder Mystery on cable. My parents told me it was really funny. You need to try it. And it's just silly. It has a great cast. It's Woody Allen and Diane Keaton as a married couple. Alan Alda is the older guy that Woody Allen feels insecure about because he's charming. He's everything that Woody Allen isn't. And he gets into his head that Diane Keaton has a thing for Alan Alda. And then Angelica Houston is, I think, like a neighbor that's part of the group. And it's kind of like in a Hitchcock movie. I don't remember which Hitchcock movie it references, but their neighbor, their older neighbor, his wife dies under mysterious circumstances, and Diane Keaton becomes convinced that the guy has murdered her.
So it's like Rear Window.
But Rear Window, like they're watching, you know, across, right? Here, no, it's just like them feeling suspicious because he's like the next door neighbor or whatever. And so what goes on is just a very silly investigation where Woody Allen tries to be the voice of reason, but because he loves Diane Keaton and because he feels like he's competing with Alan Alda, he goes along with her investigation. And it's lovely. It's like 90 minutes. It's in and out. Lots of laughs and
I can respect
nothing
that part.
Too profound.
Okay. All right.
The 90 minutes part?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we recently rewatched Annie Hall and that was pretty good for its time. I must admit, Woody Allen's not my cup of tea normally in the other one or two of his I've seen, but I haven't seen that one. So, yeah, okay. I might have to put that one on the list. My number 100, we spoke about very recently in our Hidden Gems of the 90s episode, and it's a film which is very personal. So it's one of these ones where if I didn't have the history with it that I do, there's no way it would be here, and there's no way anyone else in the world would have this film on their top 100 list. I'm talking about Judgment Night, directed by Stephen Hopkins. From 1993. Now, if you've watched this film in the last 15 years, you would just think, what the serious fuck? But if you were 17 years old when this movie came out and you were buzzed by having Dennis Leary in it, fresh off singing Asshole, that song. And it had Stephen Dorff, and it had Emilio Estevez, and it had Cuba Gooding Jr., who this is before he won, I think it's before he won for Jerry Maguire, which is sort of a couple of years after this, I think. It was just this real bro movie, and in the sense, not in a bad way that word's been appropriated now, but in a, here's a bunch of guys who are against the odds trying to survive against a bunch of other guys who are trying to kill them because they witnessed something they shouldn't have. And Dennis Leary's the bad guy, and the direction from Stephen Hopkins is pretty solid, but it is just four dudes, Jerry and Piven's the fourth guy, trying to survive a night, and it's as simple as that with a kick-ass soundtrack. And that's all 17-year-old me needed.
When was the last time you watched it?
Not that long ago, actually. Probably in the era of the podcast, I think. I mean, I had to go back to Letterboxd and have a look on it. Is there any way to look at when you've watched it again? Anyway, I have. I've literally reviewed it here. What did my review say? I don't say this very often, but you're all very harsh. Talking to the entire Letterboxd community. Four stars for this film for me. And I dig it a lot. I looked down at the list of other scores from Activity from Friends, and of the only 10 or so that have seen it, no one else rates it above 3.5 stars. So there you go.
Well, you know, 3.5 is not bad.
No, but it certainly wouldn't be anywhere near anyone's top 100. But it does say how I grade, by the way, that the bottom echelon of films on my list are 4-star films, not 4.5 star films.
Well, I probably, at some of these, most of these, I think, are not reviewed on Letterboxd. The ones on my list, I would probably give Manhattan Murder Mystery 5 stars.
There you go.
But there are movies above it that I probably at the time rated 4 or 4.5. And that's another thing. I think it was Roger Ebert that was like, don't sweat the star rating.
If Wayne was here right now, here's exactly what he would say.
Vindication!
Because in my head, 5-star films go to the top and 4-star films go to the bottom and 4.5-star films go in the middle. Because I rate them that way for a reason.
Yes, but I mean, I don't know how often or how soon after you do it. I usually log them in as soon as I watch the movie or shortly after.
Likewise.
And to me, the star rating also reflects a lot of just the experience coming out of the movie. Yeah,
recency bias.
Right off. And, you know, especially the movies I haven't been able to revisit in a while, I just know that they could go up or down depending on, you know, it's like Boyhood, but not years, just maybe weeks after.
Not two whole stars. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. You're number 99, Julio.
Number 99. The Coen brothers make their first out of like 3 appearances in my top 10 or my top 100, I think. Not a very popular movie. And it's a movie that I would have liked to rewatch because it's been a while. I think I've only seen it twice, and last time was at least 10 years ago. The Hudsucker Proxy.
Oh, with, okay.
Tim Robbins. Mm-hmm. He's the guy in the movie that invented the hula hoop. It's the movie opens with him committing suicide or attempting to commit suicide. He's like at the top of like a clock tower, and he jumps and he's falling, and then it's a freeze frame, and then it's one of those, oh, how did I get here? Mm-hmm. And then it starts telling the story. It's just really funny. I used to have it as my favorite Coen Brothers movie for the longest time.
But no longer.
Well, no, not anymore, because it was... the main thing is I appreciated just how silly and how funny it was, how quickly it moved. And seeing Tim Robbins being funny was a revelation for me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then as years went on, I got older and I watched other movies, and they came out with newer movies. You know, now I think like my highest ranked one is Inside Llewyn Davis, which... it's a completely different movie. You know, it's still funny, but it's more somber and more complex in the way it goes about things. So Hudsucker Proxy is just, it's kind of like the other side. It's like, it's the fluffier kind of Coen Brothers movie. It's not No Country for Old Men,
Burn
but
After
it's
Reading.
Than Intolerable Cruelty. Yeah, kind of like Burn After Reading or even Hail Caesar, which I loved. I know you hated it.
But... don't start me on that one. Okay, no. Good choice insofar as it's definitely a Coen Brothers film. You can't mistake they're more quirky ones, that's for sure. And there is a Coen Brothers film on my list that we won't hear it.
Really?
We won't hear it today. So I'll leave that one dangling there for when it does come up. My number 99 film can be best summarized by one line of dialogue from the film, as growled by Harrison Ford, "Get off my plane."
Really?
Yeah, Wolfgang Peterson's Air Force One from 1997. Just the idea of your American president, not your current one, but your American president kicking all the ass and being this absolute hero just really tickled my fancy. And Gary Oldman as a bad guy almost always works for me. And this film's also no exception, though he's nothing like he is in The Professional, which is a much better role for him. But it's dumb. I can't defend it in terms of saying it's a quality film, but I had such a great time with it. And anytime I put it on, and I probably haven't watched this one in 10 years, but I probably saw it 3 or 4 times through the 10 or so years after it was released. I just had a great time. And a couple of times, it's one of these films that was on TV late at night, turn on halfway and just go, yep, I'm sticking with this. And I'm not someone that rewatches a lot of films. I'd much rather get the next new experience of a film in the hope that it's going to be that next thing that really gives me that shiver of enjoyment or the like. So any film which I've watched multiple times really speaks to me for whatever way. And this film, in the dumb 90s action genre, is one of the very best for me.
I've seen it once. I saw it in theaters. And when I watched it, was before I lived here in the States. I lived in Peru. I'm from Peru. Mm-hmm. And so to me, it was, I guess, a similar experience to yours in that I had no emotional connection to the, you know, there has to be something to seeing. I wasn't watching the president of Peru kicking ass, and, you know, killing terrorists. So to me, it was just like, oh, you know, badass, like America once again on top.
Yeah, exactly. But, I think now about our prime minister, and it just would not work. It would not work at all. Sorry, ScoMo.
I don't know if you release that movie today.
No.
I mean, I just, how does that work
in
the current situation? And it's not just about how you feel about Trump, but also I think that maybe as a planet, we've all grown too jaded to put up with that kind of stuff right now.
I think that's like, a very fair statement.
To have a president that's just, I don't see how. But I remember having a good time when I watched it. Glenn Close is the vice president, I think.
She's on the ground, and William H. Macy is in it as well, and Jürgen Prochnow is the proxy bad guy from memory. Yeah, it's just one of those films where you recognize a whole bunch of people, but more importantly, when Harrison Ford kicks ass, this might be one of his last roles where he really, I mean, no, we're not going to talk about the Indiana Jones film. It doesn't exist, but this particular one might be the last of his great films from me in terms of watching him be the action hero that he was for 2 decades. So, yeah.
I guess Hollywood Homicide is not going to be on your top 100.
No. Safe bet. All right, your number 98.
Number 98. We've done 2 comedies. Now we're gonna get a little more serious. You know, we were just talking about Boyhood. Richard Linklater has made better movies than Boyhood. 3 of them are a trilogy. This one is the middle one, Before Sunset. Have you seen them?
Them last year as part of the movie watching challenge and trying to watch as many of the IMDb top 250 films as possible. They all blur together.
That doesn't count. It's all a blur.
They all blur together a little bit, but I have to admit, this one didn't. These films didn't tickle my fancy the way they did yours and most people's, because this is a really beloved series of films.
Did you watch them back to back?
No, I grit my teeth and watched one, and then I was like, oh god, I gotta watch the next one. A month or so later, I came to that.
Alex and I actually happened to watch these back to back, all in one Saturday. I don't remember we were doing some kind of project. And so as part of the project, neither of us had seen any of them. So we're like, okay, let's just power through these. On my own, I probably wouldn't have done it. Well, the first one is just so romantic and so idealized that, you know, but knowing that there were 2 more movies that explored that relationship kind of like pushed me through. And then the second one, honestly, what makes the second one for me is the ending. I mean, there's a third one, so you know that,
there's more
the second
to come.
One ends with them kind of, you know, there's more to it. But the way that they build up the movie, it's short, it's like 90 minutes again, I think. Those 90 minutes build up to that very specific ending. I don't know if you remember, but it's just basically she's dancing. He's just sitting on her couch. They've made it to her place, and he has a plane to catch, and they have an exchange, and then the movie ends. And you're like, oh my God, what? If you're a normal person, not if you're like you, Paul.
I was like, oh my God, yay, thank God that's over.
The third movie is much higher on my list, and that's because after 2 movies of being just idyllic, the third movie actually shows you what happens when the relationship is
not happily
becomes
ever after,
real.
Necessarily. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But this one is really good, and again, if it was longer than 90 minutes, it'd probably bother me more. And if it didn't have an ending that works so well, it wouldn't be on the list. But as it is, they're so good. Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. I love Ethan Hawke. I've never seen Julie Delpy being anything as good as she is in these movies. These movies were... Obviously, she's just into the character, and you can tell.
From memory, I think either the second or the third one, Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy were given writing credits because they ad-libbed / wrote so much of their dialogue that Richard Linklater thought it was only fair. So
yeah, I think it was by in the third one.
They
ad-libbed it before they shot. They would just spend, like, the three of them spent a lot of time just kind of like improvising and rehearsing all the stuff, so that by the time that they got to shooting, they already. Everything was written down, but it looks so natural that
it does.
Almost feels like they're making it up as they go along.
Absolutely give the film credit for that. It does seem real. And I guess, as you'll see from my list, if you haven't already, the way it's going, I'm not big on real. I live real. My job is very real. And so I tend to look for the fantastic and the out there in my films that I love. And there is no better example of that than my number 98. How's that for a segue? This is from a first-time director, I think at the time, a Canadian guy named Vincenzo Natali. Obviously, he has Italian heritage. And I'm talking about, again, a 90s, clearly a good time for me in films, 1997's Cube.
Never seen it. I've heard so much about it. Right, there's like three of them, right?
Yeah, and believe me when I say the second two films, they tarnish almost retrospectively the legacy of this one. There's no need to watch Cube 2, Hypercube, whatever Cube 3 was called. I can't remember. But this one is just a wonderful, very low budget, but very creatively put together film about a bunch of people who wake up in a cube, effect, or in a room of six sides with an exit from on the floor, on the ceiling above them, and on all four walls around them. And when they climb through, it's exactly the same, but different colors in the next room. It's just that some of these rooms are filled with deadly booby traps. And so our group of six or seven strangers, I can't remember exactly how many there are, start getting whittled away. And the film does this really great job of setting up the character archetypes in, it's again, a 90-minute film. And by the end of those 90 minutes, almost all of them have changed roles. So they're no longer their archetype. They occupy a different position. And that's some really clever writing. The horror part of me enjoyed the some of the kills, and the sci-fi mystery lover in me enjoyed what the hell's going on here. And not that you necessarily get a concrete answer. You start to get some idea by the end of the film. And that's what the second two films explore to far less success. So yeah, Cube is great.
So by the time you get to the end of the third movie, do you know what's going on? Is it just completely explained? They took the magic away?
Yeah, there's that. And the problem is that you get outside the cube. This film, you never get outside the cube. Right. It's completely contained, and that's the cool part.
That's why it's called Cube. Mm-hmm. It's not called Outside the Cube.
It's not called Cube and Beyond.
You've done the best job of selling me on this movie that anybody has ever done, and they've tried several times.
Okay, so it's very low budget, I have to warn you. So my fiance started to watch it and turned off after the first scene. She was so disturbed by the first scene. So she said, no, turn it off, watch it yourself. Fine. There's a lot of those conversations that happen in my house or our house.
I already know my wife, so I kind of tell her, it's not a movie you're going to like. Do you want to watch it with me? And she's like, nope.
And then, yeah, I occasionally have this moment of madness. And look, to be fair, occasionally I'm right. Like, she enjoyed It, my fiance. She hates horror films, but she got into It. So every so often I managed to pull off. And Shaun of the Dead, I think she liked as well, because obviously it's not that straightforward a horror.
Right.
But yeah, as soon as you get too gory, like, I don't know if you've seen The Hunt, but she got
not yet.
A half scenes into The Hunt and just said, nope, turn it off. And so we watched something else that night. But all right, 97.
97. Okay, my 97 is more your speed, Paul.
Oh, here we go.
It's a little less realistic, a little more fantastical. It's a director that you guys seem to love on your show. I don't remember how you feel about this. I'm sure you've talked about it.
Okay.
Christopher Nolan's Inception.
Oh, so low.
What the hell are you? No, no, no.
Holy, maybe crank out the soundboard in anger. So low.
I love Inception. It's in my top 100 movies.
I guess I'm glad it's there versus it's not.
I have higher Nolan movies in my top. I want to say The Prestige might be in my top 20. That could change if I rewatch The Prestige. I haven't seen The Prestige since it came out, but I just remember being,
See why you vote for Wayne every week in the polls, Julio.
uh, Here's the thing with Inception, and I just realized with some of these movies, really the conversation is going to be about why they're not higher. Because everybody loves why Inception. Yeah. Everybody loves Inception. Everybody knows why Inception is great. But why not higher? Why 97? And I find a lot of Christopher Nolan movies, this is not a new point. It's been made several times, but they're a little too clinical, a little detached. And a lot of Inception is great as a concept. And even though it has the DiCaprio story about his wife, and that's sort of heart-wrenching, but in the end, it's just a lot more. What I love about Inception really is the layers of deception, mm-hmm. and the travel in between the different realities and all stuff, the puzzle of it. Not so much. I always have to be reminded that there's also a love story in that movie. To me, the movie's about the heist. Yeah. The movie's in the performances are great, but they're just, you know, it's a heist movie without. I know it tries to have heart, but it doesn't really have it for me. Not okay. to put it much higher, but it's great. The fight scene, the whole, you know, when they're in their room with no gravity, when Joseph Gordon-Levitt is fighting the guy and bouncing off the walls, that stuff is just amazing. My wife was rewatching it a few months ago, and I just got hooked on it. I was walking past and I recognized it on TV, and I just sat down and I just watched the second half. Yeah, it's a great movie.
I banged on about this film a lot over the years, so I don't need to do so now. But I guess to answer your criticism, I think for me, I don't need Inception to have a lot of that heart. It has enough of it to carry it through, but everything else about the film, including the way it is plotted and how it switches between those layers, I would say almost seamlessly. Like,
yes,
the back and forth between them, you never lose what's going on. You might get a bit complicated about why what's happening in moments, but once you've seen it a second time, that all goes away. But it's just one of the most skillfully edited films I think I've ever seen as well, that you can balance out, you know, sort of basically three stories plus the car crashing in the first layer so well and be hooked on them all. So, yeah. All right. I'm glad it's on your list. Let's put it that way.
A lot of the movies, most of the movies in this list, I mean, while I was ranking them, I just had to keep reminding myself anytime a movie went down, I just have to remind myself that I love them all, that it was not that this movie was bad. It was that there was a movie that was better than it.
Yep.
Or at least that meant more to me.
Yeah, and in the end, it's all going to be personal and have that personal meaning, because these are our favorite films. We're not trying to argue objectively this is the 97th best film ever made. We're saying this is my 97th favorite film.
Where does it rank on your Nolan ranking?
It's my number one Nolan film.
Really?
Yep.
Nice.
It is. There's another Nolan film which comes very close but doesn't quite get there, but it's not The Prestige. So, in fact, there's two other Nolan films that get pretty close that aren't. Inception for me, but we'll get there eventually. My 97 is a film which everybody virtually has seen. Certainly if you're an indie podcaster, you've seen it. It made a lot of waves for the director back in 2000. Really, the second part of a bunch of waves, because his first film, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, I don't think is as good as this one. It's Snatch. From now, we're finally out of the 90s. Hooray! It's in 2000. Guy Ritchie did this one 20 years ago. Damn. And he's still making films that aren't that dissimilar with The Gentleman from very early this year. Snatch used to be higher, I would say, on my list. And I rewatched it. It fell a bit. Not 5 to 3 stars, but maybe 4.5 to 4 would probably be the case. It didn't quite hold together as well as I remembered it, because it was just so fucking cool 20 years ago.
Yep.
You know, when I was sort of in my early to mid-20s, Snatch, this was the personification of cool. From having, you know, Brad Pitt as a barely understandable gypsy, no, that's still an offensive word, I can't say, roaming homeless person who works people out, cons people out of their money. That was such genius casting and so good of Brad Pitt to sort of sully his good looks and his good name, but in this particular way. And then, you know, the introduction to Jason Statham and Vinnie Jones is back, Benicio Del Toro, Dennis Farina, such a great cast of characters, and they're all interacting in a really entertaining way, so you're never bored in this movie. It moves at an absolute lightning pace, and yeah, ultimately it's pretty empty, and there's certainly not a lot of heart, if you want to come back to that term, but it's a lot of fun, and like I said, it was uber cool, so that's why it's in my list.
It has like a little, one moment of heart when Brad Pitt's mom meets her demise, which is funny. That's my Snatch story. By the way, Snatch was on the short list. It didn't quite make it into the 100.
Oh, this is as close as we got to a crossover then for these 10.
Yes. Well, no, Inception. I'm sure Inception is in your 100.
Yeah, no, if this is in your 145 but didn't make the list, then Inception is further away from this.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah. But I watched Snatch. I liked it so much. I probably watched it like 3 times while it was in theaters.
Wow, okay.
The second time, I took my mom to watch it for Mother's Day, which is, it was a terrible idea. I already knew the movie, and yet it never even crossed my mind that, you know, that plot point with Brad Pitt's mom in the movie is just not appropriate if you're taking your mom out for Mother's Day.
Especially for Mother's Day. That's the icing on that particular story's cake.
I know, and it was happening. She never even mentioned it. I don't think she was too interested in the movie to begin with, but
she was interested in spending time with her son.
Exactly. Yeah. She's like, oh, this is what he's watching now. Okay. Yeah, I agree. It's really cool. I haven't seen it in a while. I would like to think that it holds up as much as it could. These days, you probably... I mean, I don't know how you feel. I haven't seen The Gentleman, but, you know, previous Guy Ritchie movies haven't really been my cup of tea.
Fair enough.
Last time he did something I liked was like the first Sherlock Holmes.
Yep. Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah, The Gentleman is a slight return to form, but it's no Snatch.
Yeah,
so, yeah. It's probably worth checking out. I would say so, but yeah,
I have it on my list. It's just
get there eventually.
I'll get to it. But I liked it. I remember, you know, watching Lock, Stock, then watching Snatch, and then just being excited about what else is this guy gonna make. You know, it's like even if he keeps making kind of movie,
Swept Away. That's what he went on to make.
Yeah, we all blame Madonna for that.
Yeah, we do. All right, 96, Julio.
So my 96 is a movie that I don't think is up your alley, Paul, because I don't see you as the kind of guy that would enjoy French romantic comedy.
What?
But I could be wrong.
No.
This is a very popular one, though. So maybe you know Amélie.
Okay. Amélie, yes, I do. I have seen it, and surprisingly enough, I did not mind it.
You didn't mind it. Okay. I guess that still fits my image of you. Were you just not amused by all the cutesy, quirky going-ons?
It was one of those films which a long ago girlfriend, so well before my fiance, we decided to trade sort of favorite films. So I showed her one of the films that's in my top 10, and she showed me her favorite film of all time, which is Amélie. So there's some nice memories attached to it, but I do remember being really frustrated with the last act of the film. It's like, come on, just get it together for crying out loud.
That's the reason why it's not higher and on my list. Even though I love it, I watched it in theaters and I was blown away because it's just so inventive, so visually smart.
Yeah,
and
beautifully shot.
At the time, it also felt like that kind of energy I wasn't getting from many movies. It's basically this sort of this French girl that sets out on a mission to just fix everybody's lives in a way, and but she goes about it in very convoluted ways because she doesn't want them to know that she's helping them, and there's also romance, and that's really where the movie falters at the end. It's just that it's in the end, it's just about this girl and this guy, and will they get together? And after how inventive the movie has been through all of its runtime, the climax of the movie is just, you know, her opening the door for this guy and them actually hooking up. And that brings it down a little. But still, it's just an experience. If you listen to Bong Joon-ho and you're like, hey, move past that barrier of the 1-inch subtitle barrier. This is very enjoyable. And, you know, the director has done some other movies that people are familiar with, like Alien Resurrection.
Alien Resurrection. Which is not
it's not in this list, but I like it quite a bit.
So do I. So it's nice that we're on the same page there. Fuck the haters.
Yeah. Yeah, 96, Amélie. That's the one. I think that's the one international spot on my 10.
All right. I'm just looking down my 10. No international films in my bottom 10 here. There are some later on. But speaking of 96, for me, it's the most recent film, I think, in these 10. Just looking at the list. Yes, it most definitely is. We've come all the way down now to 2012, and I'm talking about Rian Johnson's Looper.
Good movie.
I dig this movie a lot. It was just a very entertaining, smart sci-fi film. I think Rian Johnson, love him or hate him in some ways, because I think he does think he's smarter than just about anybody else in the room. And that might be his downfall in some ways, certainly when it comes to about half the Star Wars fans population. But he makes a really clever film and doesn't go about it in ways that have, generally speaking, been done before. And Knives Out's a good example of that, though I don't like that film anywhere near as much, because I'm much more wired to like a sci-fi film about assassins and hitmen
right.
than I am to like a fairly dry murder mystery, even though the characters are clever and speak cleverly and all the rest of that. So that's what this is. Even the decision to give Joseph Gordon-Levitt the Bruce Willis nose, you know, so they kind of actually look sort of pseudo-alike, I think is a good one, even though it's distracting because, you know, it's not really him. But I grew to like that part of it. And I especially like the way where the film goes. Like, it could have gotten a bit stale and whatever, but where some people get lost in the last sort of act where it's about the young version of the character, Joe, trying to defend Emily Blunt and her kid. That just elevates it for me because it takes it in another direction you don't see coming either, which I won't spoil for people who haven't seen it. But Looper I dig a lot, and it's smart. It's easy to, despite the smartness, it's still easy to consume and really get involved with. And it does have the heart that Julio has now coined as a term for me, at least tonight.
It has a heart. It has maybe the last great Bruce Willis performance.
Yeah, 100%. I can't think of anything off the top of my head where he even comes close, where he seems to be trying so hard as in this movie.
Yeah. I liked it a lot when I watched it. I haven't seen it in a while. And honestly, if I had thought of it, it would have at least made the short list.
Mm-hmm.
Which is funny because I actively didn't put Knives Out on the short list, even though I love the movie, because I just felt that I needed to give it time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then and I did put Last Jedi on the short list. Just because I don't judge it as a Star Wars movie. There's a lot of problems with Last Jedi, but what it does on the macro level, that's one of those examples where I would say I appreciate so much what it was trying to do that whatever it didn't get right, I'll give it a pass because of what it got right and what it was trying to
Fair
go
enough.
For. So,
well, more than a pass if it's in your top 145 films. That's a real endorsement.
Yeah. And I've seen it more than once, so at least it's a little more cemented.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I generally speaking would agree with you, though. There is a film quite new that made my list, which is not coming in these next five. So watch out.
Is it The
that
Rise
one.
Of Skywalker?
You'll find out.
We have a term now. We have two terms because we used to call the Elizabethtown effect is when you watch a movie and you don't like it, you think it sucks. And then years later, you've seen so many movies that are worse than it, then when you rewatch it, you're like, oh, actually, this was not so bad, which is what happened when we watch Elizabethtown. But now we also have the Rise of Skywalker effect, which is that there are movies that you watch and you like, and then the more you think about them after, the less you like them and the anger you get, which is what happened with the Rise of Skywalker for me and Alex. So
fair enough. I can totally understand how that happened in that one. Not that I've seen Elizabethtown, but okay. All right, top half of the list then, Julio, your 95th favorite film.
Okay, I think that if we are going to have a crossover, this would be it. Well, actually, no, because it might be very, very apart. But this is the one movie where I would say this has to be on Paul's list, even more so than Inception, which is David Cronenberg's The Fly.
Ooh, no, not on my list.
What?
Yeah.
What?
I'll do it
Where's
for you.
Where's my soundboard?
What?
No. Is this because you don't like it or because you haven't thought about it or you haven't seen it in a long time?
Honestly, exactly that. I haven't seen it in a long time. When I watched it, I was too young to appreciate how clever it seems to be in my mind retrospectively. And you listen to anyone who's a film critic or film fan, they tend to really love that movie. And it's a horror movie. I will watch it again and rejudge it. But yeah, I couldn't do it anywhere near really. It probably wouldn't be in my top 500 films based on my first viewing of it. But I was probably...
Paul, you think you know someone.
I was probably 16 years old when I first watched it. I wasn't sophisticated enough to really get what was going on.
And this is the thing. I'm going to watch Cube and you're going to watch The Fly.
All right, deal.
And then we'll talk.
Okay.
It's really good. It's Jeff Goldblum, Gina Davis, top of their game. It's not particularly long. I keep bringing the length of the movie, but that's because I find that it's
just
a lot harder
Boyhood.
To. But also, it's a lot harder to convince someone to try a movie when they know that they're in for like 2.5 hours, you know. But 90 minutes, you can try anything for 90 minutes. Just and this is so good that I rewatched it. Was maybe a year ago, a couple years ago, and for the show, and I was blown away by how it held up with what I remembered it was, and it's even better. I also watched the original, I think last year, and. It's good. It's completely different,
right.
But it's an interesting experience.
Yep.
It's contrasting how they took the story. Yeah, that's my 95, The Fly remake.
Okay. All right. Well, there you go. So I'll be checking that out at some stage in the near future again. My number 95, there's only two films left on my list which might cross over. There's three that are coming that just won't be anywhere near your list and probably any discerning film fans. But yeah, the guilty pleasures are, let's put it this way, are lower down the list than higher up. But this 95 is not a guilty pleasure. I think it's an extremely smart film. Again, it's from Matthew Vaughn. It's 2004's Layer Cake.
I've seen it. I went into it late. Like, I think the hype might have hurt it for me.
We talk about that a lot on the show. For me, this was just a little British gangster film. Had no idea what it was really about, except it was directed by Matthew Vaughn, who was the producer on the Guy Ritchie film Snatch and Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels. And that was enough to get us in the cinema to see it in its limited release and walked out of there going, holy shit, that was so cool. And most of the reason it was cool is because of how cleverly it and stylishly it sort of led you down a garden path and then kind of pulled the rug out from under you. Not in a, you know, you'd say a Usual Suspects kind of way. It wasn't built all around that, but it was just subtly clever. And yeah, it has all these characters or all these actors who are now basically household names, particularly Tom Hardy and Daniel Craig, who at that stage just weren't. But this is effectively Daniel Craig's audition to be James Bond, this film. And yeah, he slays it as this really stylish gangster who starts to play ends off against each other for his own gain. And you root for him to come out on top because he's relatively loyal, a relatively stand-up type of person for being in that profession.
I'm surprised that it's higher than Snatch, though. I probably would have swapped them if it was my list, but it's not my list.
Yeah, and that could easily happen, to be honest. If I sat down and watched Layer Cake again now, I think some of that luster might fall away. I've seen it two or three times, but again, not in the last 5 or 6 years, whereas Snatch I watched last year again. And so watching it with the perhaps the skewed perspective of someone who's a stay-at-home couch film reviewer for the last 5 years changes films, which I haven't done. Done, and I'm sure you're aware of that, or I felt that too. Although cinema is more your life than it is mine. But yeah, Layer Cake may not hold up to that scrutiny, but in my mind, it's a superior film, enjoyable-wise for me.
Yeah, well, I went in not knowing anything other than it was Daniel Craig and Tom Hardy and then the director, but when I watched it, my main takeaway was, wow, this just felt like Guy Ritchie, but it's not Guy Ritchie. So it's like a diluted Guy Ritchie,
okay.
Which is, you know, so that was, I was surprised because if you watch Snatch and Lock, Stock before watching this, then you can't get that thought of your mind, in my opinion. Whereas like if you'd watch Layer Cake before you watch the other two, then I can understand, oh, well, the first time you encountered this style was with Layer Cake.
Yeah, but I didn't. I'd seen them the other way in the order they came out, so I don't even have that excuse.
I love the ending. I think the ending really makes the movie for me in that one, much like Before Sunset. The ending ties it together. Mm-hmm. I should have seen that pick coming because you guys have talked about Layer Cake at least a couple times on your show. I think that's what finally drove me to watch it.
Okay. And then walk away disappointed.
I was like, oh, no, makes sense. 94.
Yep.
94. All right, definitely not your tempo. This is not even that it's French. Is that it's one of those movies that is not particularly plot-driven.
Lost me. Don't tell me it's New Wave as well, because then you really lose me.
No, it's not New Wave. I said it's not French.
Oh, I thought you said it was French. Sorry.
No. It's not even that it's French.
Oh, sorry, gotcha.
It's not French. No, it's a known director, and it's a director that has probably made movies that you love, because he made Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
It's Ted Demme, and he made Rachel Getting Married with Anne Hathaway.
Okay, I don't know if I've even heard of it.
It's my old roommate showed it to me. I was barely aware of its existence. It's pretty simple as far as a plot goes. Rachel is not Anne Hathaway. Anne Hathaway is Rachel's sister, but Rachel is getting married, so Anne Hathaway is attending her sister's wedding. She's out of rehab, and basically the tension in the movie comes from the tension between the family, because everybody kind of sees Rachel, or Anne Hathaway as kind of like the fuck up, and they're worried that she's going to mess things up. But also the wedding is taking place. It's taking place at this house. It's a lot of guests and like all these events, you know, there's a lot of potential complications. So that's, I would say, the first 2/3 of the movie deals with that. But then the last third of the movie, and what really makes it part of this list, the top 100, is just that the last third of the movie is just a wedding, and there's no conflict. It's just a family celebrating their wedding, and they throw a hell of a party, and it's just music and people dancing. And if you had described it to me, I would have said, why would I want to watch that? But honestly,
yeah, not selling it.
After watching 2/3 of the movie where there was so much tension between the family and there was so you're actually rooting for this to come through, for them to pull off this wedding, for everybody to be happy. And then when that finally happens, you just enjoy it for 30 minutes. It might be a little less than that. Maybe it's 20 minutes, but it's just people having a good time. And I come from a pretty large family. That's something that I don't have here in the States. I mean, obviously I'm married and I have friends and I have, you know, in-laws and stuff. But when growing up, I had large gatherings around me all the time. This and the kind of stuff that the last 20 or 30 minutes Rachel getting married reminds me of. It's just people that love each other having a good time after a stressful couple hours. So it's definitely, it's one of those things where you can tell. I wouldn't say, Paul, you should watch this movie because you're not going to like it.
No, I can tell it's probably not my speed, but it's obviously one that speaks to you personally, and that's why it's here on the list for you.
Yeah, and it's one of those that I think that some people might enjoy it for similar reasons. Ted Demme knows how to shoot that kind of stuff.
Do you mean Jonathan Demme?
Jonathan Demme. I'm sorry. Okay. Ted Demme has movies that are also on my list, but not in this.
It was like Silence of the Lambs. I'm sure that was Jonathan Demme, but I mean, that's an easy, you know, same last name, good enough. One of the Demmes.
Well, they're related. I'm pretty sure they're siblings.
That makes sense. I mean, he died 3 years ago, apparently, Jonathan Demme. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sad.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, you could not get any more different between your 94 and my 94. So prepare yourself. I don't reckon you would have seen this one, Julio, but I could be wrong. This is a very low budget, first time British director, a survival horror film called Dog Soldiers.
No, but that sounds familiar for some reason. I'm sure I used to live with a friend that was a massive horror movie fan.
Right.
Most of the horror movies I've watched are because of him.
Gotcha. Well, this is from 2002, so I don't know if it was around that era you were living with said friend.
We lived together in 2009 when I moved to Austin. So he had an extensive DVD collection. So that's probably something, that might have been something that was in his collection and we just didn't get to.
And it's a very simple film directed by Neil Marshall, who, you know, these days his name is much more synonymous with mud after the Hellboy debacle. But he made this film and The Descent, and they're both wonderful horror films. This one is just a heck of a lot of fun. It's just a group of British soldiers there on a training force. They encounter this zoologist and one of them gets wounded by what turns out to be a werewolf, and then it's them fighting for their lives against a group of werewolves. And it is guns, literally, like, you know, automatic machine guns versus werewolves and people getting their heads bitten off and, you know, arms slashed off. And I don't know, it's got Kevin McKidd, who went on to be in that TV series Rome, Sean Pertwee, Liam Cunningham, sort of a couple of classic British actors. It was just an absolute blast. And horror fans love this movie. If you're not a horror film fan, just don't even bother. There's nothing for you here. I have not shown this one to my fiance, in case you're wondering. So there you go.
I like werewolves. Is this the only werewolf movie in your top 100?
Think so. Therefore, is my favorite werewolf film?
Yeah. I mean, that is, I find it kind of an underrepresented genre. Everybody's always about vampires and zombies, and the werewolf doesn't get enough respect. I don't think we've had like a werewolf masterpiece that I can think of, at least.
No, and this is as bad as close to get. And the primary reason, I think, is because werewolves are a bit silly. They're a little bit stupid, you know.
You can make a werewolf look cool. They just haven't done it yet.
Well, apart from American Werewolf in London, that transformation scene, which still holds, water almost 40 years later. That's a truly impressive sequence. But yeah, this is my jam. Group of people being whistled away in gory fashion whilst you have characters that you care about. If you had to give me a summary of across genres of what I love, be it action, thriller, mystery, or horror, there it is right there. So Dog Soldiers fits the bill at my number 94 spot.
All right. I'll add it to the list. Cube sounds more my jam.
Yeah, definitely. So. I definitely recommend for you and for most people, I'd recommend Cube over Dog Soldiers.
All right. 93. 93 is the one where if we were competing, like playing for votes, this is the one where I would lose the competition.
I don't know. Have you heard my 10 so far?
Yeah, but I think that the people that love the movies on your list are very passionate about loving them.
Okay.
Whereas this movie I'm about to give you, the people that hate it are very passionate about hating it.
Oh, okay.
I'm looking at you, Nicholas Haskins. This is Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life. I'm guessing, have you seen it?
Absolutely not. Terrence Malick and I agreed to part ways after I watched The Thin Red Line and was bored within an inch of my life. And if war film bores me that badly, there's no chance anything else from that director is going to float my boat.
The Thin Red Line wasn't the short list. It didn't make it to the top 100. I've owned the Criterion since forever, and I haven't gotten around to rewatching it. I haven't seen it since it was in theaters, and I watched it there.
Jeez, and you went
Tree of Life,
and you bought the disc on that strength and never watched it. What does that tell you?
No, it just tells you that it's intimidating. But here's the thing about the Tree of Life. I think it's easier to get into than the Thin Red Line.
Okay.
Because the Thin Red Line, I can think of sequences like when Woody Harrelson and the grenade. I don't know if you remember, but you know that's like a moment.
I tend to remember lots of staring off into the middle distance with a voiceover being pensive.
Yes. Well, there's a lot of that in the Tree of Life, too.
Awesome.
But there's also, I don't know how much you've heard about it. It's crazy. It's one of those like, you have to be there. So there's one layer of storytelling that's just Sean Penn. And from what I remember, his younger brother has passed. And so on one end, you have Sean Penn walking around with his voiceover, reflecting about life. And he has flashbacks. And that's the other layer of the movie, which is Brad Pitt and Jessica Chastain raising these kids. One of them is going to grow up to be Sean Penn. The other one is the brother that dies.
Gotcha.
And it's very dreamlike. Halfway through the movie,
dinosaurs.
Yes. It goes back to like the dawn of time and the creation of Earth and the dinosaurs. And it sounds ridiculous when I'm telling you about it. But when you're in the movie, when you're watching the movie and you're in sync with it, because that's the problem, you know, it's like you have to be in sync with it. If you step back, that's it. There's no going back in. So you have to be with it. And then when the dinosaurs happen, you're just blown away. Because it's just so, so bold. And it looks beautiful. If nothing else, the imagery that it uses and watching it in theaters, it was just amazing. And the performance is the heart of it, just seeing, because Brad Pitt, it's not like he's in it a lot, but he makes an impression. He's like this rough father, and he does this thing that where he grabs the kids by the neck when he's like taking them somewhere, just like pulling them where he wants them to go. That just feels so real and so lived in.
Right.
There's not much plot to it, but the experience of sitting there and just soaking it in, soaking the images. I'm not a poetry guy. I have a really hard time reading poetry. The only time I can get into it is if I know the person that wrote it, because that gives me a way into the poem. But when it works, when poetry works for me, I feel like I felt watching The Tree of Life, where I felt that I was in sync with what he was trying to say, even though I couldn't tell you. You know, I just know that he's using this storytelling device of Sean Penn mourning the loss of his brother in order to reflect about life on many levels. And if you ask me what the ending means, I mean, I could tell you five different things and all five of them could be wrong, but they could also be I could make the argument that they all okay. are true.
I think I'll stick to the Flyer rewatch. Thanks.
Yes. There has to be at least one Countdown listener that loves The Tree of Life.
I'm
Maybe
sure.
David Powell.
I'm sure. No, David Powell, there you are. You've been. Let us know, David. Are you a Tree of Life fan? Maybe Geordi. Geordi might.
Yeah.
Go for that. All right. Again, couldn't be much more different. We go from, I don't know, metaphorical lamentation about life and death to a film about smart sharks hunting people in an underwater facility which is sinking. My 93. Is Deep Blue Sea, as directed by Rennie Harlan.
Never seen it.
Yeah, look, and I can't recommend you watch this now because the special effects are so dated 21 years on. It would destroy any chance of loving this film. But 21 years ago on the big screen, you could tell the sharks were fake, but they still kind of stood out. And
so this is a movie with Samuel L. Jackson for like 5 minutes.
Samuel L.
Right?
Jackson. Okay. No, he's in longer than that. Thomas Jane, LL Cool J, Michael Rapaport, Stellan Skarsgård. So, you know, generally speaking, they're all bit actors, and Saffron Burrows is ostensibly the main kind of character. But the best thing about this film is it's entirely unpredictable who's going to live and die. At least one half of the way through the film, or two thirds of the way through the film, it sort of starts to become a bit more obvious, though. I would challenge anyone as the credits. If you took away the names now, which you'll recognize, but Thomas Jane was a no one in 1999. And really, so Saffron Burrows, and you might recognize LL Cool J and certainly Samuel L. Jackson, but that's probably it. So it was just sort of, ooh, what's going to happen next? And there's some great lines, there's some stupid scenes, there's some, you know, awesome heroic moments, and it's just a lot of fun. It's a great action adventure with some gore, and that's what I wanted. And to my mind, other than, of course, the big notable shark film of all time, this is my favorite shark film. So it's why it made my list, and I know it's a dumb, dumb film, and I'm not going to defend it any further than that. It just, it's enjoyable.
How many stars did this one get?
I gave it 4 stars. The average weighted rating on Letterboxd is 2.7. So I am definitely in the minority, and it's not the last time I'll be in the minority, because my next film, when I get to it, is also similarly rated, and by me and the overall viewing public.
Well, my 92 is probably another low.
Uh-oh.
This might be in your list higher up. This is my one of, I want to say, 3 Scorsese films in my top 100, and it's Robert De Niro in Taxi Driver.
Okay. Oh, all right. No, not on my list.
Really?
No. No. There is a Scorsese film on my list. 2, maybe? We'll see.
Huh. Taxi Driver is really good.
Yes, it is a very good film.
The reason it's not higher for me is that I don't think that the ending works the way that he wants it to work. I don't know when was the last time you watched it. But
10 years ago, 15 years ago. I've only seen it once.
I've seen it a couple of times, maybe like 3 or 4. But last time was probably like 5 years ago or so. So the whole thing about the movie is that I think, at least, that you're supposed to be horrified by the ending when he starts shooting everybody to rescue Jodie Foster. And I don't know, every time I've seen it, I'm not horrified by it. I'm not cheering. I mean, I'm not reacting to it as if it was an action movie, but, you know, it's just one more thing that happens. I think that everything else that happens in the movie is more interesting than what happens at the end. And I have to, because I had to find reasons to move movies down sometimes. Yeah. To me, that was the reason. Yep. Why don't I like Taxi Driver as much as I like other movies from Scorsese? Well, because the ending doesn't really hit me as hard. And he's on the record saying, I mean, I've read all these interviews where he's just basically talking about how it was supposed to be an indictment on violence and you're supposed to be horrified by it. And yeah, no, that doesn't do it for me. But De Niro is magnificent in it. It's just, Robert De Niro is so good in the way it's shot. And just when you think about how young in their careers they were, and they were already producing a movie that was on this level, it's pretty amazing.
De Niro,
so, 92.
All the way up until The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle, was just an absolute force to be reckoned with. And I can't remember if Copland was before or after that, but, you know, Backdraft and the like. But every so often in bit parts, he's still really great. But the further on we go, all the way up now until The Irishman, obviously he was good in The Irishman, but there was a whole bunch of decades there where the De Niro who was such a force was no longer that De Niro anymore, sadly. So I guess he made his money and whatever else and was just taking whatever project kind of came his way that was easy to do.
I think at one point where he made that left turn into comedy, which from what I understand, it was just he hadn't done enough comedy and he wanted to do comedy. And so
stretches
there's
wings.
A solid decade. Yeah. Where he was analyze just doing comedies.
Analyze that. Meet the Parents. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It just, that's when his filmography suffered the most. And I think it took a while for him to recover. I mean, you could argue it took until The Irishman.
Yeah. But, I think you can.
I'm sure there's a couple of like De Niro movies that I've liked since then. But yeah, I remember being a huge De Niro fan growing up. And then when I moved to the States, that's when he hit the dip. He did like Showtime with Eddie Murphy. That movie's fucking terrible. But
yeah, Eddie Murphy. Don't get me started on him. We're talking about good things here. Good things, Julio.
Yes. Yeah. Taxi Driver, young De Niro. That's as good as it gets sometimes.
All right. My 92 is another horror film, and it's one of my absolute favorite guilty pleasure horror films. I got Dan and Caleb from Netflix and Swill to watch this recently as one of their patron reviews recently, 6 or so months ago. It's Final Destination 2, directed by David R. Ellis, who's sadly no longer with us. This is where they took that original sort of quite scary idea, I think, that death has a design, and if you dodge the bullet that has your name on it, then death will find a way to get you. And it's played very spookily in the first one, and Not, I mean, it's over the top. There's certainly moments where you can see where the genesis of this one come from. But in this one, they just went, screw the subtlety. Let's just go balls to the wall and have fun with these deaths. The opening death scene where they're all killed in a car accident, this massive car smash on a freeway, is incredibly well put together and really, really...
That's the one with the logs?
Log. Yeah, the logs come off and smash straight through the windscreen and all the other the carnage that happens. And the guy stuck in the car and he's burning to death and trying to get his seatbelt off. And it's killer, if you'll excuse the expression. But then later on when Death's Design this time is not just to have them step out into a street and get hit by a bus. Death's Design is to have them go to the dentist, get whatever done, then almost fall asleep and suffocate with the laughing gas and then almost get set on fire. But then they walk outside and go running across to mum and this plane of glass drops from a crane which had been hanging outside the window the whole time and squishes them flat. It is so much fun, this movie. It's so ridiculous and I have no qualms at all in saying that most people will hate this unless you're a horror film fan or can enjoy how ridiculous this is. Final Destination 2. I love it. I'm sorry.
I like the first one and I've always meant to at some point watch the rest because, you know, I like that kind of movie. I like the deaths and all that stuff. I'm more likely to go through the Final Destination series than go through the Saw series, for example.
You absolutely should. The ratio, I think, and now I know Hendo from the Movie Journey podcast is going to be screaming it at his listening device at this point because he didn't like any of these films, but if you can get behind those kind of movies, this is the pinnacle, I think, of them. 3 and 4, they're pretty average, particularly 4 from memory. But 5, because I watched them all again last year, but Final Destination 5 is a surprising return to form for the series. It's a lot of fun, and it gets the...
Oh, I think 5 is the guy that wrote Arrival. Didn't he write Final Destination 5?
Did he? I didn't know that. Okay.
I think so. I think he did one of them. Hopefully it's not 3 or 4.
And I think with the way that you put an emphasis on endings, I think you'll really dig if you get through to 5, you'll be like, ah, okay, yeah. And they never need to touch it again. They should never make another one. Those 5 films, arguably, just knock out number 4 or just watch the YouTube deaths scenes put together. But just watch 1, 2, and 5. I reckon that's the way to go.
It's still not above Cube on my to-do.
No,
but
no, fair enough.
But I will get to them. I've been meaning to, like I said, because I heard that the Arrival guy was involved in one of them. And I liked the first one fine.
Yeah.
I remember having fun. I've seen some of the deaths in the second one because I've seen the whole sequence with the opening sequence, the traffic accident.
Yeah, you said the log. So, yeah. And then even in number 5, I think it is, to the credits, they do a montage of all the best death scenes from the series.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is pretty cool. All right, here he is then. The final choice for today. It's weird to say number 91 is our final choice, but here it be. Julio, what is your 91st film on your list?
91st is the one movie that I wish I had time to rewatch because I've only seen it once, and it was a while ago. And I remember liking it a lot, a little bit like Layer Cake. It came with a lot of hype.
Okay.
It's a different friend. It's one of his favorite movies. So he'd been pushing me, hey, when are you going to watch this? When are you going to watch this? Finally, I think he gave me the DVD. I finally watched it and I was like, that was great. But obviously, it was never going to live up to how great he told me it was.
Mm-hmm.
It has a killer cast. Keira Knightley, Carey Mulligan, Andrew Garfield. The director's Mark Romanek, which I don't know anything else that he's done. Oh, he did 1 Hour Photo, apparently.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one. Okay.
The movie is Never Let Me Go, which you might have heard of.
You have to refresh my memory, Julio.
The poster is the three of them just kind of staring off into the distance like you like. I mean, there's very important revelations throughout the movie, so I'm not going to give you the entire lowdown on the plot, but basically these three, the three main characters are being, you know what, I'll tell you the main thing because it's sort of common knowledge for people that know the movie. So they're clones that are being just grown for parts.
Okay, yep.
So it's just the tragedy of their lives that basically they grow up to be harvested. When they reach a certain age, that's when they start being taken away. Some of them don't last past the first surgery or two. Some last like after, you know, up to 4. But basically they know that the time they have is very limited. And there are things that they can do to extend the time before they start going for surgeries. There's a love triangle between Carey Mulligan, Andrew Garfield, and Keira Knightley. And it just, most of the movie is just them trying to find a way to kind of live longer.
Yeah, okay. You know,
find a loophole in the system that
sounds
will allow them
dark
to...
Sounds pretty dark and dismal. And yeah, those kind of films appeal to me more than sweetness and light. So, okay. I'm having a look at it here.
Yeah, it's very sad. It's very more like... there's a lot more of melancholy, not so much like the darkness. I mean, the darkness is there, obviously, because of the setup. But it's just more about these three people that slowly learn how bad of a hand they have, how bad of a hand they've been dealt. Because growing up, they don't know about this. And then slowly, throughout the movie, they realize everything that's happening. And then just how they handle the fact that, you know, they have emotions and that they have a shortened lifespan. And it's just really, really, really good. And like I said, it's one of those movies that the more I thought about it, the more I liked it, to the point where I wish I'd be able to rewatch it, because then I could tell you for sure that it's as good as I'm building it up in my head now. I'd know it was good enough when I watched it.
Well, yeah, it's pretty good at this particular level, but okay. All right.
Yeah. It's definitely, that one's, I would recommend to anybody, and it's not even 2 hours, so.
All right. Well, my final film for today on my list, my number 91, and there is no crossovers. There are no crossovers, Julio, so there we are.
Yep.
I wonder if it's a film that's higher on your list because it is from a very well-regarded director. It's 2.5 hours long, so I think it's the longest film that we've spoken about today. It's Inglourious Basterds from Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Making my list, when I was ranking the hundreds, I surprised myself by putting Inglourious Basterds above Pulp Fiction.
Ooh, damn.
I know. It just happened. I was like I was going through it really fast. I was like, it has to be a gut feeling.
Yeah, it does.
It just happened. Is this your lowest ranked Tarantino?
Yeah, there's more Tarantino to come in my list for sure.
Okay.
But I liked it just fine when I saw it the first time. It went up in my estimation on a rewatch. It's probably right on that borderline of 4.5 stars for me, which probably most films are at this particular point. I think this is Tarantino probably really coming to own his style, this particular film, and everything since then has very much been other than Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is his own beast, but you know, the Django Unchained and the Hateful Eight, and I'm missing something, I'm pretty sure. But they're very build-up tension release, build-up tension release, build-up tension release. And there's no better example than the first scene. I think the whole film doesn't gel together as well as I would like, and that's what holds it back a little bit. Like, I thought there was a lot more bastards in the film than there actually is. They're relatively almost sidelined by Melanie Laurent's character's sort of story. She's almost the main character in the film and they're almost the supporting players. But when they're on screen, I think the film really does shine. Brad Pitt having an absolute blast playing Aldo, I can't remember what's his name, Aldo Raines. He's great. And when the guy they bring in, why can't I think of his name off the top of my head, damn it, the German dude who sort of joins them as well. It's even fun seeing Eli Roth as, you know, the guy who, the bear Jew as well. So there's so many great characters in this. Diane Kruger is absolutely beautiful in this movie as well. And Tarantino throws all the blood and the gore at the wall at the end. Oh, and of course, how can we talk about this film without mentioning Christoph Waltz and his star-making turn? Most of his work has probably come from his role in this movie where he is amazing. And Tarantino resists the temptation to give you the obvious ending. So he gets points for me for that as well. So it's a great film.
First time I saw Michael Fassbender in anything, just mesmerized.
Yep.
The first time I watched it, it really threw me off when he changed history. It just I was not ready for it, and so that really kept it in the back of my head. That's what I've held against the movie. But really, the more I think about it, I've seen it since then, and I think especially once you see the rest of the movies he's made, the other theme that I would pick up on is just that. He suddenly, you know, the revisionist history aspect of it, where he just expresses, I guess, our collective rage towards something. Mm-hmm. And he's like, well, fuck it. I'm going to make a movie where I just make it right because I can. So he rages against Nazis, rages against slavery, rages against the Manson murders.
Yep. And this is the first example of that here. Like, it didn't see it coming. Well, I didn't see it coming because it was the first time he'd done something like this. And then because of that, in some of his later films or his most recent film, I suspected what was probably going to happen. At least it wasn't going to go down the way that you thought it would. So
yeah, I appreciate that now more than anything else. I mean, I love the way the movie's constructed and everything, but just the fact that he's just making this bold choice to just express righteous anger, I guess, and portray retribution. It's like, why not have, you know, Hitler die this way? That, to me, that's why I realized I don't have anything like that in Pulp Fiction. I don't get anything that strong from I love Pulp Fiction. It's so good. It's just, I quote it. I love every scene. I've seen it so many times. But when it came to comparing, then I was like, what gives you the biggest jolt of Inglourious Basterds?
Well, we might. I'm not sure. I haven't sort of thought this part through, but as we go with the different podcasters that come on, I might ask them to give me their whole 100 if they're willing to do so, and we can kind of put together a meta list and present that on the last show as well. But we'll see maybe then how high it might go for you. But of course, things could change before then. But give us a quick run through of your 100 through to 91 then as a recap, Julio, and I'll do the same, and then we'll wrap things up.
Okay, so starting with number 100, Manhattan Murder Mystery from Woody Allen. Number 99, The Hudsucker Proxy from the Coen Brothers. Number 98, Before Sunset from Richard Linklater. 97, Inception from Christopher Nolan. Number 96, Amelie from Jean-Pierre Jeunet. Number 95, The Fly remake from David Cronenberg. Number 94, Rachel Getting Married from Jonathan Demme, not Ted Demme. Number 93, The Tree of Life from Terrence Malick. Number 92, Taxi Driver from Martin Scorsese. And number 91 is Never Let Me Go from Mark Romanek.
All right, my recap then. Number 100, Judgment Night from Stephen Hopkins. 99 is Wolfgang Peterson's Air Force One. Vincenzo Natali's Cube is my 98. Guy Ritchie for a Snatch at 97. Ryan Johnson's Looper is 96. 95, Matthew Vaughn's Layer Cake. Neil Marshall's Dog Soldiers at 94. Rennie Harlan's Deep Blue Sea, Shut Up Everybody, is my number 93. Number 92 is David R. Ellis's Final Destination 2. And this one I can be proud of. At least my 91 is Inglourious Basterds from Quentin Tarantino. And that is it for today's bonus episode, the countdown to my favorite films of all time and Wayne's ultimately when we get there. Julio, how do our listeners, thank you so much again, for joining us today. How do our listeners find your show and check out The Contrarians?
Just look for The Contrarians everywhere, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, wherever you listen to your podcast, we're probably there. On Twitter, you can find us at Contrarian Prime. On Instagram, look us up at Contrarian Prime. We have a friend of ours that helps us with some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, and she's like, you need to push the Instagram because not enough people know that we exist on Instagram.
I understand that. I'm also terrible at Instagram. It's just the last thing that I ever get around to.
Well, I've gotten a lot better at updating the stories, and she's taking care of the photos and the clips, so it's just we're trying to drive more traffic there.
Okay.
But I mean, you know, I'm pretty active on Twitter, so
for sure.
Twitter is probably the easiest way of reaching us if you want to just yell at us for something we said on the show.
Well, there we go. And look, obviously, I'm a big fan. Thank you, Julio, for joining us. And do check out The Contrarians. As a thanks to Julio for spending all this time here today with me and giving and spending all the time organizing for this show. I think that was the big commitment that he made.
It was a lot of fun.
So thank you so much. You know where to find us if you're listening to the show already. And thank you so much for your support of the show. Thanks for checking out these bonus episodes. And, well, I'll be back next month or probably the month after or maybe, who knows, maybe 6 months from now with 89 through to 80. It's been a pleasure. Thanks again. My name is Paul.
My name is Julio.
And this has been Soundboard. And of course, we can't really go too much further without hearing from the other host who's not here.
All of your arguments are like my asshole, man.
You can decide who that one is. We'll catch you next time. Cheers.